This edition of the Monocle Arts Review was first broadcast on the 22nd of October 2015 on Monocle 24. Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. For our weekly book review, I'm joined by Arifa Akbar, literary editor of The Independent. On our reading list this week is John Crow's Devil, the re-released debut novel by Man Booker Prize winner Marlon James, which is hoping to reach a larger international audience since he took the literary prize last week. Plus, we'll discuss the posthumously released ghost story Little Sister Death by William Gay, and we'll end with a series of short stories by Irish author Colm McCann, entitled 13 Ways of Looking. That's all to come here on the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. Welcome to the show, Arifa. We're going to begin the show with a re-release of a book that hopes to find a new audience since its author, Marlon James, scooped this year's Man Booker Prize. In the wake of the success of the winning title, A Brief History of Seven Killings, James has re-released his debut novel, John Crow's Devil. This book was originally rejected 78 times before it was finally published in America back in 2009. And in September this year, it was released for the first time in the UK. Now, I understand he actually threw the manuscript away before it was published. Who encouraged him to retrieve it?
I heard this story last week because I was fortuitously sitting next to him at the Booker dinner. And he said that 10 years ago last week, he nearly didn't become a writer. He was in advertising and graphic design. He had sent this book off, and all he said was a book about demon possession and two preachers. He'd sent this book off to publisher upon publisher. They'd all come back with rejections, and he'd literally deleted it from his very old fashioned computer. And then he was somehow, a very long story, forced to go to a writer's workshop in Jamaica, where he was living in Kingston. And a writer called Kaylee Jones was there. And it seemed like there was conspiracy around this book at that workshop, because people were encouraged to bring published work, any unpublished work. And he said he didn't have any. And his friends knew otherwise and said, hang on a minute, weren't you working on a novel? He very reluctantly handed over this manuscript to this teacher who'd come to workshop everybody's work. This Kaylee Jones, the writer, was so struck by what became John Crow's Devil that she offered to edit it for free, and she did. She was his editor. And that's how he carried on being a writer.
Right, okay. So can you tell us a little bit about the about the storyline of John Crow's Devil?
Yeah. So, as he says, it's about demon possession and two preachers. It's set in Jamaica of the 1950s, but it could be sort of an Old Testament remote village. There's something very epic and very Old Testament about it. It is about two preachers, one who's an alcoholic, very liberal preacher. He's lost the heart and soul of his church. Another preacher who calls himself the apostle invades his church and basically takes over. And it's, in one sense, it's a battle of control between these two preachers. This second preacher is a charismatic fanatic, and it can be seen as a parable for good versus evil, even though there's no such thing as good in this. Everything seems to be quite confused. You know, does good have some evil in it? Does evil have good in it? But it's also can be a parable for the post-colonial identity. This is set in the late 1950s. Jamaica won its independence from the UK in 1962. It could be a parable for religious mania and fanaticism, and how people are led, aren't they? They're led like the, I suppose most obviously I could think of the Jonestown massacre in Guyana in the 1970s, but also Nazi genocide, and how people are led by the charismatic fanatic and religious manias, and even ISIS. So I was reading this and seeing all of that in it. But in some ways, I suppose those are the ideas, that those could be the interpretations behind the book. But I was thinking, am I enjoying this book, and how powerful is this story? And I was just blown away by this,
okay,
the power of this. And, remember, it was rejected 78 times. So I was thinking, I would see signs of why it was rejected. And I couldn't. It's just such a good first novel. It's just, actually, it's a good novel rather than a good first novel.
Right, okay.
And it's got all the signs of what will come later in his novels, like the graphic sex and the graphic violence.
Well, I was going to ask about that because obviously, I mean, we should compare it to A Brief History of Seven Killings, the book that has just won the Man Booker Prize. In what ways is it similar? In what ways is it different? Mm. I mean, that was, as you say, very violent, but it was also set in the same place.
You're right. The Brief History of Seven Killings is also set in Jamaica a couple of decades later, but it is still dealing with themes of power, corruption, sexuality, sexual obsession, sexual perversion. It's all there, but this is much more biblical. And I think with each, I've read all three of Marlon James's books, and I'm struck by each of them, and I think, God, this is the most powerful, most terrible. But now I've just finished reading this last night, and I'm currently thinking the violence is this in this is as terrible as the brief history, because brief History of Seven Killings, the violence there is, and the sex, it is so graphic and it's always appalling. So he said, Marlon James said last week, I don't believe in PG violence, and he's been compared to the likes of Tarantino, because actually each three of his books are very filmic. You can see them. They're so vivid.
Right.
But he said, I don't believe in PG violence. But I was talking to him about this Tarantino comparison. He said, I wouldn't compare myself to Tarantino because I will never allow this terrible violence to be entertaining or glib.
And so actually, it's not glamorized in the same way that you might find it in.
It's always appalling and it's always shocking. So whether a man is getting stoned by villagers here, or a woman is getting whipped so her back is flayed and resembles butcher's flesh, it's always really appalling, so it never ceases to shock.
I mean, I'm sure we could talk about that for an entire 50 minutes, but that was John Crow's Devil was originally published by Akashic Books and has been released in the UK by One World Publications. We're going to move on to something a bit spookier now. Little Sister Death is a novel by the late American author William Gay. This horror story was discovered after his death in 2012 and is being released posthumously this month. Arifa, before we get onto the book, tell us a little bit about this writer, and because he didn't actually publish anything until he was in his 50s. That's quite unusual.
He's just really unusual. I have to put my hands up in shame. I hadn't heard of him before I picked up this book, and I felt I should have heard of him. They've heard of him in America, but one of the reasons why many may not know about him is because he started writing late, but also he only ever published three novels in his lifetime. He did publish lots of short stories as well. Many writers became admirers of his, so including Stephen King, and they were mutual admirers. And he is a writer that deals with Southern Gothic, which also was unfamiliar to me. But so picking this book up was a bit of a revelation, because the Southern Gothic deals, it's American, of course, but it just sort of deals with this combination of derelict or haunted settings, sinister events, and flawed characters. And so this particular novel deals with something in Tennessee's folklore called the Bell Witch Haunting. It's an event that's said to have taken place in 1804, early 19th century, when John Bell, a wealthy man, and his wife and children, six children, moved into this remote but huge farmstead, and sightings began to be seen. So a dog in the cornfield, a woman, a sort of succubus-like woman in a green dress. Then, gradually the sinister events came closer and closer. So there were obscene whisperings behind the walls. There were scratching of rats. It seemed as if the demonic possession sort of moved into the house, until this family, it became a sort of obsession.
Right. So what does William Gay kind of bring to this version of it?
It takes that old 19th century historian modernizes it. So what he's done is contemporized it. We start the story in 1982 when a writer, his name is David Binder, he has written a surprise hit. He's written a novel and it's just become this great hit. He can't believe his luck. But then, of course, the pressure's on for him to produce another hit and he's running out of ideas. So this is so he takes his family, very young family, a wife and a young child. He's read about this, the Bell Witch haunting, and he goes and visits the farm. The idea strikes him that this could make a good story. So really, the haunted house story he's inspired to move there through writer's block. So it's really a story about the haunted house and everything that his young family encounter and his slow unravelling, because the price he's paying is, you know, for the writer's block. He's got himself a story, but actually there's a price to be paid for that story.
And you mentioned Stephen King earlier. I mean, obviously, yeah, just going through the storyline there are clear echoes of another story of a writer and his family in a remote location. That's The Shining.
Yes.
Which we all, yes, I guess, know of. Tell us about the parallels there then.
Well, the parallels are most definitely there. The fact that we're starting the story with a writer who's stuck. He's stuck for a story and he's seeking the space, the isolation, the placid remoteness, the place that he thinks will bring the story to him is the place that haunts him and drives him, you know, insane. And doesn't that remind us of Jack Torrance and his, you know, his mania and the all work and no play will make Jack a dull boy? Do you remember that horrific scene? There's nothing as fever pitch in this. I think that the fear and this house rustling awake, it's almost as if this house has been waiting and the disturbance has been asleep and it's woken up now with this family's arrival. And that fear chimes with the fear of the writer that he will have no more ideas and the creativity is spent. And it's a sort of creative unravelling, which is there in The Shining, as you said, and it's there here.
Wow, sounds eerie, but fascinating as well. Little Sister Death by William Gay is out now, published by Faber and Faber. We're going to end with a collection of short stories now by Irish author Colm McCann called 13 Ways of Looking. The book is comprised of four tales, but let's begin with the title novella, Arifa, as this one managed to entwine itself weirdly into McCann's own life off the page.
It's kind of, if we're talking about eerie stories, this could be quite eerie. I was struck by the story, but I was much more struck when I read the author's notes. So the story is about this. McCann, by the way, moved from Dublin to New York in the 1990s, and a lot of his stories are based around New York and America, and as this novella-sized short story is. It's a story brilliantly told, just beautiful prose, about a retired judge. His name is Mendelssohn, and we enter the story sort of in his head, and his head is an interesting place. It's really reminiscent of the past, but also acknowledging the frailties and vulnerabilities of his present state. He's old, his wife has gone, he's not close to his son, he's there with his nurse. It soon becomes evident through this narrative that this is the last day of his life. And we accompany him inside his head until the very moment of a street assault. So he's basically murdered, and it seems like a senseless attack. And then the narrative pulls out of his head and it takes us to the CCTV cameras along the road and a police procedural and a courtroom drama. It sort of changes its shape, this story. And it's about ways of seeing how we see being seen. And so I won't tell you any more about the story because it's got a real punch at the end. But then, you know, you proceed on. There's three more stories and they're very engaged with violence, assault, mortality, menace, but also the writing process. But at the end, so you read this collection, you think this is a great collection, these are great stories, quite dark but great. And then the author's note is sort of final metafictive punch, because Colm McCann says this first story was written before he himself was violently attacked on the street in a sort of seemingly senseless attack. It's quite a serious attack, which left him unconscious. And the last story, which is also about violence, violence towards this woman, was written, but it's also involved with this sense of revenge and this idea of forgiveness. That was written after his assault. But what struck me was that he seemed to suggest that, you know, he's a very postmodern, people call him a very postmodern writer. And he has this very postmodern suggestion that real life can mimic or echo fiction, which in this case, in the sequence of the events here, you feel a bit of a chill up the spine. But then it's an interesting idea, isn't it, that fiction can dictate reality or somehow prefigure it.
Yeah.
And then he has other really controversial suggestions in his acknowledgement. You know, he says, in the end, all fiction is autobiography, however much we try to deny it, maybe more so when we try to deny it. So these are interesting ideas that sort of, they're there in these stories, but it is a collection of ideas, but it's also a collection of really good stories, so you don't have to get metafictive or postmodern about it.
Right, I see. I mean, as if we do look, sort of take a step back and look at the collection as a whole, I mean, how do they sit together, these stories? Are there pervading themes that kind of hold them together?
I think that it's going to make this collection sound a bit somber, but there is a theme of death, or proximity to death around these stories. I asked Colin McCann, I spoke to him, and I was intrigued by these stories, and he said, well, actually, his dad was dying while he was writing these stories, and he hadn't really realised that there was this theme running through it. But you have the death of Mendelssohn, but there's something very vigorous about Mendelssohn's mind, being inside his mind, even though it's the stories about death, because there's so much fizzing and there's so much life going on, his past life, his present life, the physicalness, the physicality of his life. And then we go on to a story about a mother who thinks her son is lost, presumed dead, and the harrowing nature of that. And we go on to a female Marine in Afghanistan facing, you know, the close proximity of sudden death at any minute. And the last story is really a powerful story about this nun, Sister Beverly, and she is watching television, and she suddenly sees a face that she recognises, and it turns out it's the face of the man that kidnapped her in South, decades ago, kidnapped her, sexually tortured her, assaulted her. And she decides, and this man has now sort of transformed, apparently, and is politician in the making, and she decides she's going to go and face him. So, you know, there are themes of, you know, revenge, or is she going to seek revenge? Is she going to allow for forgiveness? So there's a lot going on. But so you can see the themes are dark, aren't they? But there's really energetic writing. And there's also, you know, comic, surreal. So when you're inside Mendelssohn's head, there's a lot of surreal comedy. The writing is just very alive. So even though the themes are dark and deathly, there's something of the lightness of the writing that really balances it.
Excellent. Well, I'm sure we could talk about that for a long more time as well. But unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. 13 Ways of Looking by Colin McCann is out now, published by Random House. And I'm afraid that brings us to the end of today's show. Arifa Akbar, thanks very much for joining us. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. Join us again at the same time tomorrow for our weekly film review with Tim Robey. But for now, thanks for listening and goodbye.